Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 107 of the Alexi Sale podcast, of the so-called Alexi Sale podcast. It's what you call it, soi-disant Alexi Sale podcast. Self-proclaimed. Yeah, Alexi Sale podcast. Self-identifying as the Alexi Sale podcast. I self-identify as a podcast.
Yes, our pronouns are podcast.
Yeah. My pronouns are it and that. I don't know.
Each to their own. So, each to their bloody own.
Who, where, what, when, who, wow. So main thing as number one on the agenda, comrades, is report back from the founding conference of what is now officially known as your party.
Yeah, what a twist that was.
Yeah.
They did a big vote. Yeah, one of the big votes was, what should we call the party? I didn't like the options.
No.
There was your party. It was the, was it Progressive Alliance? No. What was the Alliance one?
So I don't know. People's Alliance.
People's Alliance. Thank you very much.
Your party, our party.
Our party. And then the Left Party was one of them.
No, that wasn't. Didn't even make it onto the ballot.
I was like, surely people could have come up with better.
No, I suppose, you know. But, you know, I always think the name, you know, people say it's a terrible name until the things, you know, the Beatles is a terrible name for a band. But once they started making hit records, it became irrelevant, really. So
that's true. We just need that hit record.
Yeah, we just need that hit. So first of all, I would like to say there was quite a good article in the Guardian website yesterday by Andy Beckett, a former guest on the show, I think.
What did he come on the show about?
I think he came on the show about some book he'd written, didn't he? About, I don't know, I sort of delete these, you know, interviews with people, I'd sort of delete them because otherwise my hard drive gets clogged up.
Yeah.
And I might forget something important, like how to go to the toilet.
The Searchers. Yes, he wrote The Searchers.
Yeah. And he came around and he's very nice and I'm like, you know. And so he wrote a rather interesting article, I thought, or a rather hopeful article, just about how he spent the Sunday at your party conference, and he's just saying that it is, you know, it was messy and loud and shouty, but he remarked on, you know, maybe this is what democracy looks like, really, that he had a sense that I think that in rejecting the single leader model, the conference and the membership, although by a narrow margin, but was also rejecting the politics of bureaucracy, the politics of what they used to call in communist parties democratic centralism, this idea of a very tight, small group at leading the party and handing down.
Which is a major problem in the Labour Party, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's a major problem with any party, really. Yeah. So there was a rejection of that, really, and it's, in a way, a rejection. Of the people around Corbyn, Carrie Murphy, Len McCluskey, those sort of remnants of the trade union movement and the Labour Party, I think people had become suspicious of. And in a sense, not a rejection of Jeremy, but a kind of almost a drifting away, in a sense, to say to Jeremy,
on,
what was that phrase, Gwyneth Paltrow and the guy she was married to, I don't know, amicable. Chris Martin, yes. I can't remember what the phrase
smell
was.
My fanny candle.
No, not that.
Could you, an apple a day?
Chris? No.
No, that's the name of our child. I didn't
What they described, or she described, their splitting up as a willful decoupling or something, I think it was. there was an element of that, really, to say to Jeremy, you know, you're very important to us and you've been a shining beacon of light, but the time now, this is not going to be your party to...
Conscious uncoupling.
Conscious uncoupling, that was it. to say to Jeremy, you know, we love you. It's not about you, it's about us. But, you know, we don't want your style of politics, really.
Mm.
We don't want a Labour Party Mark II. We want something different. And, you know, we thank you for your service, but you're not going to be in charge of this thing.
It's like we're young, we're energised, and we're here because of you.
Yeah, we're here. We love you.
We're here to fucking shake shit up.
Yeah, yeah. So, there's still a long way to go because this committee's got to be formed and, you know, there's obviously opportunities for the dead hand of bureaucrats to seize the process. But I took solace from that, really, that there seems to be a kind of wisdom of crowds kind of vibe going on. Linda said that Linda representing as a delegate from the Alexis L podcast that was there, and she said she was very impressed with some of how articulate a lot of the people who spoke from the stage, but people who spoke from the floor. And I was listening in on a Camden People's Alliance meeting. Another delegate was saying she had also that she'd actually changed their mind several times. She'd been swayed, which is, you know, the essence of democracy in a sense. You don't just, you know, go there with a fixed position and then act on that position. That they had felt themselves swayed by the arguments being made in a very democratic fashion from the floor. And so that was very impressive, really. Linda also spoke about how impressive the foreign speakers were, that there was somebody from the Belgian Workers' Party, which had gone from a very small kind of fringe communist party to like being a major force in Belgian politics now by a kind of...
Yeah, I saw him speak.
Yeah. Also from France Insoumise, obviously somebody... from France Unbowed, and you know, again, just you know, these are left parties that are playing a significant role in the politics of their countries, and so if they can do it there, there's no reason why we can't
exactly
do it here. So you know, I mean, it obviously was.
Can I just say
Come closer, Linda. Come closer.
Brave effort.
Do you want to come and just say, just come and speak into this?
Very quickly, because I'm late now.
Please.
So Linda is going to give us a report back from conference.
I'm going to give one thing. It's a very brave effort to connect everybody on the broadest of lefts, from the far left sort of Trotskyist groups to the socially conservative, so-called, because we've all got working class things in common.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's a brave attempt. You think it'll succeed? You don't know what it is.
Linda Sale. Before you go, a quick question.
Little Muslim boy's got a quick question.
From
the
Little Muslim Press.
Yeah, quick, she's late.
Considering what you just said, what about the expulsion of the Socialist Workers' Party members and stuff?
What about the expulsion of the Socialist Workers' Party members and like that?
That was just bad publicity. I mean, Socialist Workers, it was overturned by conference. At the moment, you could be in dual groups, but they are to be determined which groups you'll be allowed, you know, think about the Greens and so on.
Yeah.
The Socialist Workers' Party itself does not allow any kind of dual membership, so I'm wondering how they're managing to square it with their own very strict...
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks, comrade.
Linda. Thank you, comrade.
Thank you, comrade.
Linda Sale there.
Yeah, Linda Sale there. So,
interesting. Okay, yeah. That's, and I didn't. So bad publicity, and what? So they overturned that ruling then?
Yeah, apparently on the conference itself overturned, which was obviously coming again from those people around Jeremy, the Cary Murphys, and the whoever else.
Quite hypocritical of them to kick off when their party doesn't allow them to be in multiple parties.
Yeah,
interesting.
I mean,
how a headline really affects the way you think until you just.
Yeah,
if I can think about it or talk about it a bit further, but yeah, go on.
I mean, they would maintain that there is no conflict because your party is explicitly a party that plans to stand for elections, and the Socialist Workers Party doesn't do that, doesn't put up candidates, at least under the name of the Socialist Workers Party.
Right.
You will never and have never ever have seen a candidate in an election standing for the Socialist Workers Party. So that's
do you know about these SWP people? Because I want to know more. I remember growing up, my dad would always tell me to ignore them.
Yeah.
And we're very left wing, and I'd be like, why? And my dad would be like, ugh, they're assholes or something. He always had a big distaste for them. And I didn't know why. And then I want to know, but then that would mean having to get to know them better, which I don't want to do. So, but why? What is it?
The original sin, the split, the Socialist Workers Party are Trotskyists, and this is the kind of the.
So was my dad? Yeah, carry on.
Trotskyist.
Yeah.
It must have been some other sort of Trotskyist then. This was the great split in Soviet Russian communism in the 1920s after Lenin died prematurely of wounds. He'd received an assassination attempt. There was a struggle for control of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which came down to two.
What are you saying? It just comes out to their Trots versus Marx. Marxists.
Well, they're all Marxists.
Okay, sorry. But,
so the struggle was between Stalin and Trotsky. And Trotsky was the military genius. He had commanded the Red Army and already done bad things, really. The suppression of the sailors' uprising at Kronstadt and so on, which had been brought about. But, you know, maybe the condition of the Civil War, you know, it forced him into that position. So anyway, there was a split essentially between Trotsky and Stalin, which, as we know, Stalin won. Trotsky was then essentially became an exile and finally ended up in Mexico, where he was murdered by agents who got into his conference over many months in his household and then killed him, and I think in 1941. But at the same time as Trotsky was the sort of prince over the water, he developed a different theory of revolutionary politics wherein he said that socialism could never be achieved in one country, that the revolution had to be essentially international. It had to happen all over the world. And that therefore communists needed to be profoundly internationalist and, you know, all times foment, I suppose, and encourage revolution in other nations. Whereas Stalin believed that you built communism in a single country, i.e. the Soviet Union first, and then from there you could kind of build outwards. And in a sense, I think that Trotsky was proved right, really. It has proved that you can't really build socialism in one country. I mean, certainly, you know, you've got a very effective state, capitalist/communist state in China, but I don't think that's where anybody would really label as socialism. But and this is where I don't really understand. Maybe somebody can explain. So those two ideologies really seem to attract different people with different goals. Now, what Trotskyists tended to do, for instance, they have this idea called, I think it's called the which seems what the most stupid idea I've ever come across, which was the transitional demand, I think it's called. The transitional demand. This is where, like in labor disputes and stuff like that, you would, if Trotskyists were leading the dispute over wages, they would demand a ridiculous like 5,000% pay rise, knowing that the employers could never deliver on it. Then, when the employers failed to deliver on this demand, you could then say, well, look, this is capitalism. You know, it would foster revolutionary consciousness by the employer failing to meet. And so they would do that. They would kind of enact that policy in all kinds of different areas, really, to demand the impossible, really. And to do that, you would highlight the failings of capitalism. They also had, you know, entryist policies. Obviously, militant that militant took, we were Trotskyists, took over Liverpool City Council and Lambeth in London and stuff like that. And again, I think that they would always be, they would enact policies that were very flamboyant and very ambitious. They wouldn't be realistic. They wouldn't think about things that you could do, but always demand the impossible in a way. And I mean, I know Linda had experienced very, very early on when she was still in Liverpool that they were living on a council estate and there was a rent strike. And all the Trotskyists, particularly students, came along and you know, urged the people in the rent strike to not pay their rent, obviously, and to make very militant demands. Then when the summer came around, all the students went home. This rent strike collapsed and the people in the housing estate were left owing massive amounts of back rent that they couldn't pay and so were evicted, really. And that tended to be, I think, a pattern of Trotskyist movements, that they would come in, get everybody worked up, and then would fade away again. I mean, I'm very happy to have somebody.
What was your question? This started as a question.
Yeah, right? It wasn't a question I asked. You asked me.
But you were like, there's something you're unsure of, maybe people at home.
But no, I'm just going to say, if somebody else got a defense of Trotsky and Trotskyism, then I'm perfectly happy to hear it, you know. But that is my, I mean, I come from a family of communists, of you know, people who for a long time followed the Soviet line, really. And so we're naturally antipathetic towards Trotskyists, really. So, you know, there's a certain kind of just football teamism perhaps going on here that I was always brought up to be suspicious of. Groups like the Socialist Workers' Party, you know, but I mean, they are very good on, you know, a lot of those, you know, campaigns, those single issue campaigns, you know, Rock Against Racism and all that, were Trotskyist led. Mm. You know, and you always see their banners, you know, on Palestine
marches. So you're like interchanging Trotskyism with SWP.
SWP are Trotskyists, yeah.
But they're very, okay. So I wonder now, because, you know, when my dad...
I mean, communists and Trotskyists are all Marxists.
Yes.
So, like, you know, Protestants and Catholics are all Christians, but then there's a huge gap between them. Or, indeed, Sunni and Shia are all Muslims, but there are...
So what's the counterpoint to Trotskyists?
Doctrinal... Communists, really, or everybody else.
Communists versus Trotskyists.
Yeah.
Because my dad would talk about... So, maybe to clarify, my dad, when he would discourage me from giving the geezer outside the station 50p for the SWP newspaper, my dad was older at this point. My dad was older at this point and a lot less militant.
Yeah.
So in the 60s, he was in the PLO and fucking proper revolutionary and getting kicked out of his country. And then in the 70s here, he was with the PFLOP or one of those abbreviations that is one letter away from being a very similar but mortal enemy Palestinian Liberation Organization. So there was like the PFLOP versus the PLFOP or what, you know, and my dad, and this is, you know, pulling on memories from my youth, but he'd be like, oh yeah, they were communists and we were Trotsky. So we were at each other's throats all the time. And I'm like, don't you have the same fucking end result? Like you both won. Why? So maybe he had a, he must have had an experience with the SWP in the 70s or something. Yeah. That just left him with a bitter taste in his mouth.
I think they have a tendency to use people up and burn them out, I think.
You know, like a lot less revolutionary in his older years as well.
Yeah, well, that happens. But, I mean, you know, I think there are certain – I mean, again, I'm happy to listen to a defense, but there are aspects of – you know,
me too. I'd love to hear a defense. Yes,
but this, you know, so you know, there is a certain amount of cult like behavior. I think, you know,
where does Galloway
actually
lie?
Comes? I don't know what Galloway is. Actually, I don't know.
We got a lot of his defenders listen to our show, and I don't need to hear any more defense of him, please. But any SWP or Trotsky?
Yeah, I don't know where he lands on that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to know. I would like to hear that. Hearing you speak on all that. So eloquently and, you know, just pulling from your knowledge on the history there of between Stalin and Trotsky. Which one of them got killed with the ice pick?
That was Trotsky.
Okay, yeah. In Mexico.
Stalin, you know, Stalin died in his bed.
Yeah, he did, didn't he?
With it clutching his teddy bear. He didn't, but I mean, you know, he got to. There's not, you know, there's not, you know, the universe does not always take revenge, really. Stalin lived to a ripe old age and died in his bed.
But hearing you speak on all that could perhaps, I know you're reluctant to go back to it until we've released your book, but that could be a nice topic for the next chapter of Dances.
Yeah.
A little narrative, I mean, a story there, a timeline.
Yeah, I'm as I say, I'm very reluctant to fuck with the kind of the pure nature of those dances, which is just the dance and then an explanation of Trotskyism. But yeah, there's of Marxism.
You gotta take a risk, man.
Oh, I don't want to.
So Andy Beckett says in his Guardian article, before the conference, a YouGov poll showed that 12% of Britons would consider voting for your party. That's pretty high.
Yeah.
While down by a third since the party's launch, so that's gone down a third, the figure is still surprisingly high, given all the turmoil. And no party scored more than 29%. Our politics remains in a fragmented and volatile state, not least because of Labour, Reform, Tories, blah, blah. The Greens and Lib Dems currently have fewer negative associations. But the Lib Dems' opportunistic, ambiguous politics is unlikely to lure many of your party's socialist supporters. But the Greens, so this is, the Greens, I think, are still seeming to be a less risky choice. But your party perhaps is more exciting and more hands-on, more democratic. Right, would you say?
Yes, I don't know. I don't know what the structure of the Greens is, really. But I think that the Greens are obviously got it, you know, they've been around for a long time and therefore they've kind of sorted out to a greater degree than your party who they are and what they stand for. I think the potential appeal of, I mean, as I think Andy Beckett mentions in that article, the potential appeal of your party is that its base is theoretically much wider than Greens, which I think tend to be. Again, you know, I'm happy to have somebody from the Greens, you know, come on to say otherwise, but tends to be kind of middle class, you know, politically conscious. Whereas the potential base, and there's, I think that was Vince, you know, that your party has a broader base in trade unions, in local working class communities. Mm. And, you know, in a broader international, you know, potentially a broader international, you know, I mean, in ethnic minority communities.
The Muslim votes as well.
Yeah, well, for instance, here, I mean, the Camden People's Alliance, which is not your party, but, you know, it's got very, you know, it's had very useful cooperation with the Muslim community, with the organized Muslim community here. And I think that that's an advantage that theoretically your party could leverage, so that the, you know, I mean, this is all best case scenario, but that your party, you know, there'd be certain areas where your party is stronger than the Greens, and therefore they should take the lead, certainly in terms of electoral contests.
Well, there seems other areas. To be an agreement, perhaps rumours of an agreement, that they're not going to stand in each other's way in target seats.
Yeah, exactly.
And I just noticed something that I didn't even consider, is that they've instantly got four MPs in Parliament.
Yeah, and then two others who are kind of sympathetic as well, I suppose. Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
And he finishes the article with, so your party may survive, at least until the next general election, when winning a few seats could give it leverage in a hung parliament. To maximise its chances, the party appears to be moving towards an agreement with the Greens, like I just said, yeah. Was this politics of survival, small gains and participation as an end in itself what people were expecting when they started talking about a new left-wing party in a packed room a year ago? My sense is yes, with good reason. There are fewer wild optimists and more realists on the British left than there used to be.
Hmm. Yeah,
more realists on the left.
Yeah, and that also, that, you know, that idea of small gains, you know, of not demanding an immediate, you know, that Britain becomes a, you know, anti-colonial state. Yeah, but just a kind of incremental, seeing where you are, just trying to make gains, and then seeing what those gains bring you, and but not having necessarily grand vaulting ambitions, but just seeing, having principles and core beliefs that you don't shift from, but on the other hand, just seeing how you can inch your way forward, really. I mean, I think that that seems to be the only way that, you know, that advances can be made, really. And I mean, I think that Linda's point about a broad coalition of the left, really, I balked when Zara Sultana says you cannot be socially conservative and be in this party. I don't think that is for her to say, for a start. But I also think that that excludes, you know, people on the left, really, that you can, obviously Muslims, for example, who are working class, oppressed, anti-colonialist. Why you would want to exclude those people, I think is, you know, you're landing yourself with a huge problem, really. And, you know, essentially share the same aims and objectives as everybody else. They just come from a different, more socially conservative background. And, you know, if this is going to be a broad alliance, then I think there's got to be space for everybody who shares the aims of working class liberation.
But there needs to be a discussion about how your, you know, even if you don't want to call it prejudice, your prejudices can't, there has to be a line drawn where you shouldn't affect other people in the party. And,
sure.
You know, because there are, you know, to bring it down to what is the obvious issue, is the trans issue, is that there are some people who believe one way with trans rights and in within your party. And there are trans people, and I saw them go up during conference and speak on the stage. And they should have the right and the space to do so, feeling like they're not being judged
or
have that space to go and speak and take part in this democracy that they're trying to create there.
Absolutely.
And so how can, you know, how can we make it a safe space?
Yes,
you know, I'm sorry to throw this, you know, new age language. You know, how can we make it a safe space for everyone to be involved?
Yeah.
Where it's hard to call it a disagreement when it is literally someone's whole being that they disagree with. You know, if there's a member of your party who doesn't think you are who you say you are, that's more than just a disagreement, isn't it?
Well, I think without squaring that circle, it's not, you know, no progress. You are excluding a huge segment of your base, either, you know, the young pro-trans people or more socially conservative Muslims. I don't know. Or not. I mean, don't blame the more
that's
socially
not just
conservative.
Muslims at all.
Yeah,
we know older, that
older women.
Yep.
For example, you know, first, second wave feminists.
Exactly.
Yeah. The truth is that socialism will solve all these problems. That if you have a society in which we all live equally together in mutual respect for each other, then these problems will disappear. And that's mm-hmm. what I think that that's what
well,
we have to be
but
working
But you just
towards.
Said mutual respect for each other.
Of course.
So isn't that a tenet that, shouldn't that be a condition for you to be in the party if you have to have mutual respect for everyone else there?
Yes.
So some of these
but
people...
How that respect is adjusted. I don't know. I'm not the, you know, thank God I don't have these.
We're not
going
to fucking solve it here. No, but
no,
it's important to be, because these people are so, some of them, even there are some TERFs out there who are just like, whatever, just stay away from me and my kids or whatever, or whatever, you know, as wrong as they may be or whatever you want to think of them.
Unlikely to be socialists.
But they're not going to be.
No, we don't want them.
They're not going to. No, I'm saying that's the light version. They're like, whatever you want to do, just stay away from me. But like, they're not, at least they're not going to treat you in a horrible way. But there are people who just will just always be sneering and looking down on you if you, you know, if you identify a certain way or whatever. But I don't.
Well,
think,
I just think
I haven't seen evidence
to...
of that. And what was his name? The guy that people was it Shawkat, the one who had Shawkat. Said.
There's two that left, Iqbal Muhammad and...
the one Zahra had a problem with.
I think Adnan Hussein.
Yeah. I think what he said is on the much lighter side of what fucking people out there are saying. Your Linehans and Rowlings and that.
Yes, like, absolutely. Yes, yes,
like,
exactly.
That is the kind of thing where, okay, that's your belief, fine, but you're still going to talk to me and treat me like a human.
Yeah.
We can sit here and have a conversation about fucking childcare and, you know, workers' rights. But if you're coming in going, you're not looking at me as a human being.
No,
you
of course
can't
not.
Sit there
yeah,
and have
the Linehan Rowling axis. No, obviously, we and they're not. I mean, it's one of the things that Linda makes, is that when people are vehemently anti-trans, that it tends to, they tend to have a lot of, all their other positions are horrible as well.
Bleeds into their other facets, yeah.
Has gone very, you know, apparently very Zionistical. Obviously, J.K. Rowling is a raving, and her agents are raving Zionists. Mm. And that is completely unacceptable. But I think that there is, again, you know, I'm happy to listen to voices saying yes or no to this. But I think that is one of the, it is one of the positions that your party has to, one of the debates that your party has to weave its way around, really. And, you know, can, I think, with goodwill. And, you know, in the realization that our ultimate aim is socialism, and that socialism will genuinely dissolve all those boundaries, you know, will because if you, you know, the oppression is primarily financial, that we have a, we live in a capitalist state where the majority of people make all the shit, and then a different, extremely small minority of people own all the shit. And that inequality, from that inequality derive all other inequalities. And if we remove that inequality, then all the other attendant inequalities simply vanish.
That's the hope. That's the hope, isn't it?
Indeed.
Okay, shall we draw a line under that? Your
yes,
party?
I hope that that's helped with you know, people who were there, people who weren't there.
Well, I guess no. Let's summarise. Have you given up hope? Have you already holding on? What do you think?
It's a roller coaster ride. Linda had to go to bed for about 3 days when she got back, and she was so kind of drained from the experience, you know, that. You know, it really took it out of her. But yeah, there is at the moment, there is hope there. There was, you know, there was elation at first when it was first announced. Then there was kind of terrible gloom when, you know, all the shenanigans were going on. Mm. And now there's hope again now. And let's hope that situation maintains. It's still going to be messy and difficult, but then, you know, this is a birth. Births are always messy and difficult. And hopefully the rights, you know, the child that will be born of these struggles will be a beautiful, will grow into a beautiful.
Between 8 to 10 person. Fingers and 8 to 10 toes.
Yeah. If it's got its tail, it's only a short one. Oh, nice fluffy. It's got a nice fluffy tail. And pointy ears. Oh, it's a cat.
It's a cat in the end.
Yeah.
And like they're considering now which parties you're allowed to be a member of. Because that's obviously you shouldn't be a member of Reform and your party at the same time. So there's I think it's smart to draw a line.
Yeah. And you know, you know, the Trotskyists do have a history of being entryist, of taking over parties. So you have to watch that. But I that's not my problem. I don't know what the solution to all that is. But I think I would come down on the side of a generosity of spirit at this point. Really, we can have the purges later.
Okay.
Don't you find it eggy when people who you admire appear in the middle of their podcasts and beg for money? Like Sam Cedar, for instance, on the Majority Report. I find it particularly eggy when he drops in and he says, we even take phone calls too. So that's what I'm going to do. You know, you're going to lose all respect for me when I say, if you want to become a supporter, go to patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast. And I even don't take phone calls.
That's right, folks. Support the show, get extra content, and help keep this machine running by visiting patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast.
And don't just think about me and Talal. Think about our robot, too. He's got to fight Gregory Blinkoff's robot to the death, whatever he's fucking called.
They haven't heard that yet, Alexi. That's in the next segment.
Oh, well, you can put that at the end.
They don't know what you're referring to. I can't put it at the end. It's in the middle.
All right.
Stay tuned to find out what the fuck Alexi's talking about. All right, back to the show. All right, here's a little palate cleanser for you. I don't know what this question means, but Malte asks, what was the inspiration for Monsieur Aubergine?
Monsieur Aubergine was in the second and third series, I think, maybe third series. I don't know, of Alexi Sells stuff. It was written by my two other writers, David Rennick and Andrew Marshall. And it was a kind of parody. Well, it was a parody of several things, really, because we didn't like to just parody one thing. It was obviously a parody of Mr. Bean. But it was also inspired by this kind of Marcel Marceau kind of French mime characters. And so it was very funny, actually, and you know, it worked really well. I mean, it worked really well on its own terms as a kind of Mr. Bean kind of mime, malevolent, silent character, but it also, you know, it was also a parody of Monsieur Bean, Mr. Bean. That's why it was called Monsieur Aubergine.
You're wearing like a tuxedo leotard.
And yes. A
very tall top hat. You're walking into a co-op. You're a very good physical performer.
Yeah.
You're pouring your milk into your trolley, which obviously goes straight through it. Give the empty bottle to it. Why are you looking at condoms now? You're going through all the condoms.
Let's see what happens then. See
There's
what...
Angus Deaton, the shop manager. He's angry that you're throwing condoms around the shop. You've gone through them all. Ah, you've got an idea now. Is this fun? You've gone over to the bread section. You found a baguette.
You've taken the wrapping of the baguette and you're like, that's better, because all the condoms were too small. I get
that's
it.
That's right.
Now you've walked off and you've mistaken someone's baby in their cart as your trolley, and you've stolen a baby and it's got loads of shopping on its head. And now you're looking at the cassette tapes, and you've taken the cassette tape out of the package and started pulling the reel, and you're listening to the music as you're pulling it out. And then some people from the loony bin, I suppose, have put you in a net. They're dragging you out of the shop in a straitjacket, and you've met yourself. Alexis Sale is outside the co-op in a van, and they've put Monsieur Aubergine in the back of Alexis Sale's van.
Complicated stuff, eh? Works on many, many different levels. Yeah, so it's
the condoms were too small for your massive dong.
That's right. Funny shit. Where are you seeing this? On YouTube?
That's on YouTube, yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully you made 0.0001p from me watching that. That's very funny. Yeah, I just looked to a Monsieur Aubergine and that came straight up.
And just to say, next year, one of my pet peeves. Yeah, funny shit. Yeah, what grinds my gears is that partly that series stuff and the old new Alexis Sale show as well are, you know, not really. I mean, they have their followers, but they're not. They should be higher up in the kind of hierarchy, the canon of great 80s and 90s comedy than they are really. And so I think it's like in February at the Bristol Slapstick Festival, they're doing a retrospective of stuff where I'm going to be interviewed by Robin Inson talking about trying to restore stuff its... Because it was endlessly inventive. I mean, both David and Andrew were, you know, great writers, really at the top of their game. And, you know, combined with me, it was a really magical kind of combination, really. And Marcus Mortimer, the producer-director as well, really, that, you know, between the three of us, I'm with... At the time, massive BBC budgets. We did some really, really clever shit, you know. And I don't know whether it's a scheduling problem. Or I don't quite know why. It doesn't really get shown a lot, really. Probably as a, you know, I think because I'm being penalized for my anti-Zionism. I would say that's definitely the explanation.
Of course, yes, certainly.
By the Israel lobby, it should be cited more often in examples of great TV comedy. You know, at the time, you know, it was amazingly. It was usually number one or number two on the BBC Two, chart that week. Hmm. You know, with the viewing figures of like 4 or 5 million, which these days would get you number one on ITV One. You know. So yeah, I mean,
what can we do?
Well,
when do they? How do they ever rerun? Can we need to get you on UK Gold? Do they ever play your shit on there?
I think they did in the early days. I don't know whether, as I say, I think somebody told me once it's maybe a contractual problem or because they'd have to find everybody who was in the show, living or dead, and pay them fourpence. Okay. It may be that, or I don't know really.
Well, I'll do that. I'll do that if it means it gets the show on the telly again.
You'll do what? Pay everybody?
I'll find out. I'll go through the credits and find all the people.
And give them their share. Okay.
I'll give them the fourpence, yes. Give them their share. From your bank account.
Yep.
I think you're right. Those shows deserve more attention.
Yeah. It was very innovative. You know, there was stuff in there that... Nobody's done before.
There is one event coming, hopefully a long time in the future, that will bring a lot more attention to those shows. But unfortunately, you won't be there to see what.
Yeah,
well,
I'm prepared to. I'm prepared for that.
Speaking of Robin Ince, let me just plug something. On the 19th of December, Robin Ince has a thing called the Cosmic Shambles Network. He runs with a few people. They're doing a show in London called Nine Lessons. Apparently, it's quite a well-known thing. Nine Lessons and
I've
Carols.
Done it every year, yeah.
Nine Lessons and Carols for Curious People.
It's at King's Theatre, I think. And I'm doing the one that's on the 19th of December, Friday 19th.
Oh, cool. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's sort of that got me back into doing stand-up as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in about...
It looks like it's like a lecture.
2010
right?
or 2011, eh?
It's all like doctors and scientists doing
lectures. It's a variety of things, yeah.
But he's asked me to just come and sing some of my silly songs. Do I have to like frame it as a lecture?
I don't know. Ask him.
I'll ask him. But yeah, so I'm going to be doing a little spot. I have an interesting email to read you. Did you have something else you wanted to say?
No. I'll continue to whine on about why stuff isn't. And I think it was also, you know, I mean, Charlie, I mean, not that, I mean, it was perfectly legitimate. I was, and I shouted at him at the party that Charlie Brooker took some of what I did, which is that sort of walking in a location, but doing what is effectively stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
Doing it to camera, which is not, I had no patent on that. It was perfectly justified. But Charlie Brooker is a much more fly individual in terms of, you know, moving on up within the hierarchy of entertainment business, and now is a very powerful producer, whereas I've got this podcast.
I'm sorry.
Which is, it's apologize. All, you know, it's all, it's, yeah, no judgment. But, you know, he was more effective at selling himself than I was. So, you know, there's some of the fact that stuff.
It was also,
not,
he wrote a whole series.
That as well. I wrote a whole series, but they just weren't as popular.
Oh, right. Okay, sorry. Carry on.
But, it's also my failing that stuff. I shouldn't just blame the fates. I should also say that it's my failing that stuff is perhaps not more.
Your
vaunted.
Books are very popular.
Yeah.
And they came after stuff, you know. His no one, like, I think people probably watch his old screen wipe TV show as much as people watch stuff, and, you know.
I guess. No, I mean, I'm impressed with his career arc, mm-hmm. really. I think he's done remarkable things, yeah. And that, you know, that Black Mirror is now on Netflix and all
it's
that.
It's been a bit quiet
that.
On the old Palestine thing.
Well, yes, exactly. Yeah, there is that.
So I had a very strange email that I want to read to you, okay? This is in this was in response to an episode a few weeks ago called Gossip from mid-November.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the title was Gossip. In the episode description, it starts by saying, Alexi and Talal spill the tea and get their gossip on. It's being very funny here. Get out of town. They said, what about Starmer? You don't say. The BBC lost how many bosses, etc. Then there's a PS. Sorry about Talal's audio quality. He forgot to plug his microphone in. All right, that's the podcast description. Now, I received this email. I want you to tell me if you notice anything strange about the email. Okay? Mm-hmm. It's from someone called Gregory Lyakov, who is a columnist, I think, for the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, yeah.
There's no reason to think this isn't from him.
Right.
And apparently he's like the youngest American columnist.
Mm-hmm.
He's still a teenager. Anyway, here's the email. Hello, Alexi and Talal. I had a real laugh during your November episode when you both started swapping wild gossip. And frankly, made Talal's unplugged microphone almost feel like a feature rather than a mishap. The off-the-cuff chat about the BBC's disappearing bosses and the lively debate around Starmer were just the sort of candid commentary that keeps me tuning in. Plus, your exploration of the principles behind the Palestinian liberation struggle struck me as bold and thought-provoking, the kind of honesty rare in most podcasts. That's the opening gambit of his. Have you noticed anything?
Sounds like it's written by a machine.
Yes. Okay, good. You did notice. I was testing you a bit there. 100%, right? That is an AI email, right?
Yeah.
That he has
He goes on to ask if he could be a guest on the show. All right. I'm Gregory Lyakov, the youngest nationally syndicated columnist in America, with regular features in the Wall Street Journal, New York Post, and The Hill. So there's a little blurb, probably a pre-written blurb about himself. I believe your audience would appreciate hearing stories from behind the headlines that I encounter firsthand. If you're interested in bringing columnist perspective. But what a strange approach. So there's probably some program that he's logged into and is like, scan all podcasts, read their blurbs, make an adequate response, ask to be a guest on their shows, right?
Yes, yes.
And this AI speak, the way AI speak is so obvious.
Yes.
Who would fall for that? Especially as he's like 19, 18, 19, and he thinks he should know better that we wouldn't read that and not see through it, right?
Well, maybe he's banking on that we've got a machine reading our emails. And so our machine goes, thank you, Gregory. We find your columns in the New York Times, on The Hill, thought-provoking and amusing too. And we would love to have you on our...
Yes, we love the way you praise Israel's policy on Palestine. Yeah. He is a massive Zionist, pro-Palestine mouthpiece, by the way. A pro-Israel mouthpiece, yes.
Oh, this is just spam then. It's got nothing to do. I mean, he just sent this to everybody on the planet, and he doesn't love us at all.
And then he follows up with an email bragging that he's had been fortunate to connect with figures like Charlie Kirk and Alan Dershowitz.
Oh, fuck's sake.
Giving me an insider's perspective on current media narratives. And then, there's another AI bit. Your podcast has a reputation for cutting through the noise, and I see a compelling opportunity to discuss the realities behind educational reform and the fight against anti-Semitism, which are both growing topics.
Oh, it's obviously...
Go on.
No, it's obviously seen some, it's seen some words we use about anti-Semitism and thought we're pro-Israel, I guess.
Yes. Or maybe he's messaged all Jewish podcasts.
Possibly.
This one. Most of our podcasts, when possible, have a transcript attached to the kind of digital file. Right. So you can like search keywords and stuff. So that is possible. So, but just how strange that this guy, Gregory Lyakov, real writer, real person, and I can't see why this wasn't generated in some form by him. Strange approach, man.
Yeah.
Really, really strange.
Well, we can get our robot to write back to him, I suppose.
Oh, and he writes for the Times of Israel as well. I'll get my team of robots to respond to his messages. We love your massive glasses and the grin you wear whilst sitting with war criminals. I have lots of acne cream to recommend. No, poor kid. It's always sad seeing kids get sucked into this Zionist.
Probably works for him in terms of money and adulation from... powerful people.
Yeah.
It's still not, it's still in your interest if you're a craven coward to take the Israeli lobby's dollar, it's still, we're getting there, but we haven't made that a career-ending choice at the moment, really, sadly. I don't know whether they had I was just listening to Radio 4 News, and it said they're doing the headlines on the 1 o'clock, and they said, where that one? They said, four countries say they will, withdraw from Eurovision because of Israel's participation. We speak to Maureen Lipman. And then they had a clip of her talking to Johnny Dime and said, why am I not surprised, Johnny? This hatred of Israel, and even before Israel existed, has been going on for so long. I think fucking whining self-pity of her Jewish supremacy is just repellent, really.
It's the wrong person to cut to anyway. We should cut to... Now we're going to speak to someone to explain why these countries chose to do that and why there's such a massive movement against the Israeli government and a boycott movement.
That's who you cut to explain it,
not someone to fucking whinge about it.
And nobody's buying this explanation. You know, it's anti-Semitism anymore. But nevertheless, I just wonder whether they had somebody apart from Maureen Lipman on speaking about it, you know, or whether that was just entirely...
But no one's buying it, that anti-Semitism line, but they still push it on the as the narrative.
No,
because in the mainstream,
that's all they've got.
Yeah, they still push it, and it's still what they talk and write about, so that in future historians who will look back on it, that's what they'll see. They won't see what we're talking about on the street. They'll see like the papers of record and the TV shows of record speaking of anti-Semitism. And they'll go, another dark age where humanity had an anti-Semitic turn. Yeah,
I don't think that's going to happen, really. But, I mean, I just thought, are you fucking... I mean, fuck you, BBC, for having air on, but also, you know, I don't, like I say, I didn't. I mean, we had to do the podcast then, and I'm not going to listen to it. But I just wonder whether they had some other voices... you know, telling the truth as opposed to her whining self-pity.
Who cares what Maureen fucking Lipman has?
Yeah, mind you, when we did Carry On Columbus, me and her got on very well.
Oh, really?
I think she went insanely Zionistical later, really.
Zionistical. Oh, yeah, there it is, Carry On Columbus. That's 15th in her... most popular, her list of movies and shows. Carry On Columbus is 15. All right, I've got one last thing. I've got an update on the Cilla Black mystery.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Really, when we hung up last week and finished recording, I went straight onto a wonderful research resource called YouTube.
All right.
Yes. And I
little channel called YouTube.
Yes. And I popped in the words Alexis L. Cilla Black. Guess what popped up? It was, because we had discovered during the recording that Cilla's goodbye to the 1980s might be
where we worked together.
Where you worked together. And then I looked it up, I found a full version of it on YouTube. There was a half version of it, but there's also a full 1 hour long version, which Mark on our Patreon pointed out as well, but I did find it before you told me, Mark, I promise. And yeah, so you come out, Alexi, at some point, and you present an award. Do you remember this evening?
Oh, that's right, it's coming back to me. Yeah, I remember the prop. Yeah
it was like a big scroll.
Yeah
It's this award, and I guess she just did this award show for everything 80s. And you give out the award for best drama.
And I'm doing this in all seriousness.
You're being very sincere. Yeah, you kind of drop a joke. You make a joke about...
I didn't. I wish I'd been more...
You're being very sincere. But you did, like, you were talking about the importance of theatre. And then you mentioned, you made a line about Liverpool theatre being very morose and very dramatic. You're being a bit bashful and coy with her because I think she compliments you when you walk out. And what do you award? Who do you give the award to? Oh, one of the nominees is Brideshead Revisited, which perked my interest because you love Evelyn Waugh. Yeah. But they didn't win. What else? Excuse the slowness here. I'll type it in the edit. Boys from the Black Stuff was the other nominee. And then they play like really fucking painfully long clips of each fucking thing. The Jewel in the Crown is the third nominee.
Presumably
that's it. Who do you think wins?
Boys in the Black Stuff.
Let's find out. Alan Bleasdale.
Yeah, Boys in the Black Stuff.
Oh, it must have been an best drama actor then.
No, Alan Bleasdale wrote.
Oh, he wrote it. Yeah, out he comes. Yes, yes, he's one of the writers. He's got some serious eyebrows.
Yeah.
Wow, he looks like me if I don't groom for 3 months. And then you're standing there while he brings out all his like fellow cast and producers and everything. You're standing off to the side. And they're making a right palaver out of all this.
Yeah, God, I did some stupid shit. I wish I'd...
You presented... What do you wish? What are your regrets there?
Well, no, I just think, you know, I should have kept my... I mean, I didn't... I would never...
You should have done
sometimes
it in character.
I forgot. Yeah, I, you know, I tried to be a more... you know, just somebody in show business, really. I didn't always... You know, Stuart's got... You know, so Stuart... I mean, he's learned from my mistakes, I suppose, and we did... Talk about him presenting Top of the Pops the other week, but I'm looking very embarrassed about it. But I should have kept more purer, really, and just done more stand up and not really fucked about with stuff like presenting Shit for the Black. But I just thought, well, I just kind of like being in show business to a degree, really.
Yeah. So.
But I think that was a kind of strategic mistake, really.
Did you have aspirations to be that kind of famous and like be a presenter? You wanted to, did you want to be a presenter yourself?
Well, you know, I probably, if somebody offered it to me, I should have kept my ideological purity more purer, really, because I think it would have given me a clearer sense. But it's, you know, when you're doing something for the first time, as essentially I was doing, you know, as a you know, Marxist light entertainment. You know, it's you make missteps, really. But so I think I wish in retrospect I'd been more.
Hey, man, you're not alone, dude. We're all just figuring this shit out as we go along.
Yeah.
Okay, mistakes. I've made a few, right? I think that about does it for this week. Okay, Alexi's gone full beast mode.
Hey, Alexi, you've got to end the podcast.
All right, what was I? I thought of a funny song, but I've forgotten it again now. All right, I'll have a think. I would just like to say, plug the Patreon. Usually plug the Patreon.
Well, what I want to do actually is when we finish this, I want to record an ad for it with you.
Okay.
And then I'll slot it into the middle of the show.
All right.
Okay. And actually, I might leave this in for the end of the podcast so that people know the behind the curtain a little bit. But yes, yeah, so I was planning to do that with you.
All right.
We'll slide it into an ad roll in the middle. Sound okay?
Sounds fantastic.
Okay, great.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Free Palestine.
You've been listening to the Alexi Sell podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexisellpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.